Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I am your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week, on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like many other state-licensed enterprises, it's regulated by the Welfare Department or the Department of Family Services or the Family Court. Now, the best part about it is that you have absolutely no input into or say-so over this marriage license, the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of them. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. You know, marriage is the most important, and it's also the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding, and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. Now, about 67% of all marriages in this country end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms of your marriage contract before you marry. And you should be the one writing that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. Now, whether you're married or not, you should give me a call at 417-273-4967 and ask for my free general law CD package. And let me tell you more about this thing called marriage and the marriage license. It's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's an easy one to remember, georgegordon.org. Click on the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Or you can call direct. It's 417-273-4967. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. We've been talking about Parthia, the ancient forgotten superpower. There's a sidelight in this book, in the chapter 3, is called The Untold Story of Jesus Christ's Life. His childhood years, birth to age 12. You've probably heard something about that. What you probably haven't heard is the connection between Parthia, the Israelite tribes, North America, Carthage. And what did Jesus do? Where was he spending his time between age 12 and age 30, which the Bible is totally silent about? Is there something written in secular history? Are there hints and clues in the Bible as to his connections to Parthia, Carthage, and the British Isles? Well, much has been written about the life of Jesus Christ, the historical person whose name is attached to the many different denominations of Christianity that exist today. In fact, so much has been written that one might wonder whether anything truly new could be written about this one life. But as you'll see, new facts about the life of Jesus Christ can be ascertained by combining the accounts in the Bible with secular historical accounts and traditions about the time in which he lived. And this chapter is not intended to be a complete history of the life of Jesus Christ. It'll cover those aspects of his life and times which have not been generally known before. Now, the prior chapter, dealing with the Parthian Empire, discussed historical events shaping the world into which Jesus Christ was born. When some surprising information about his life is added to the history contained in the previous chapter, it can be seen that Jesus Christ actually played a role in the great power politics which occurred between the empires of Parthia and Rome. And the Bible hints that he could have played a much larger role in the political affairs of the era had he chosen to do so. So first of all, let's take a look at this question. Did Jesus really live? Well, there is no doubt that the person, Jesus Christ, actually lived in Palestine at the beginning of the first century AD. While some skeptics doubt this fact, in this chapter we will begin by offering firm evidence that Jesus Christ was a real historical person. For instance, Josephus, a Jewish historian of the first century AD, regarded the life of Jesus Christ as an established fact. In Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus wrote that there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. Unquote. Now that was Josephus in Antiquities of the Jews. In this account, written shortly after Christ died, Josephus not only gave us a powerful witness that Jesus Christ truly lived, but also provided an independent corroboration of many of the biblically discussed events of his life. Josephus refers to him as a wise man and wonders whether he was more than a mere man because of the wonderful works that he did. That a non-Christian Jewish historian of the apostolic era writes of the miracles of Jesus as actual facts offers contemporary support to the Bible's accounts about them and him. Josephus agrees with the testamental writings that Jesus was sentenced to be crucified by Pontius Pilate at the behest of the Jewish Sanhedrin, the principal men among us, he used the term. And Josephus also acknowledged that Jesus Christ fulfilled many prophecies of the Hebrew prophets about the Messiah, and even refers to his resurrection as an historical fact. Josephus' reference to Jesus as the Christ acknowledges that Jesus was the Messiah, the Anointed One. Since a non-Christian source so close to the actual time of Christ was confirmed these facts of his life, the musings of modern skeptics questioning Christ's existence are totally without merit. As we say in court, they're specious, frivolous, without the foundation or merit. Now, Josephus could speak with eyewitnesses of Jesus' life. Modern skeptics are almost 2,000 years removed from the events, and their writings are merely speculative conjecture. Jesus Christ did live, and the writings of Josephus substantiate the Bible's claims of his performance of supernatural deeds as well as his being raised from the dead. Roman secular sources agree with Josephus. Celsus, an anti-Christian writer of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century AD, wrote, quote, "It was by magic that he, Jesus, was able to do the miracles which he appeared to have done." Here is a Roman opponent of Christianity, grudgingly acknowledges the reality of Christ's miracles, which he labels as magic. However, Quadratus, writing in approximately 117 to 134 AD, urged people to believe in Jesus because the effect of his miracles continue up to the present. People had been cured and raised from the dead, and some of them have survived even to our own day. Tacitus, the famous Roman historian writing about the Christians just decades after the death of Christ, stated, quote, "Nero fabricated scapegoats and punished the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were popularly called. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate." Unquote. Tacitus' comment about Christ appears to be a mere aside in an overall account of events in the reign of Nero. It is particularly compelling evidence that Jesus Christ really did live. Tacitus was no fan of Christ or Christianity, and he had no axe to grind. His account that Christ was a real person crucified by Pontius Pilate is highly credible, as Tacitus refers to it as an official act of Pontius Pilate within his overall accounting of Rome's activities. Clearly, then, Roman accounts confirm that Jesus Christ lived and that he was executed in Judea during the administration of Pontius Pilate. Even his detractors acknowledge that he performed supernatural deeds. Whatever your views about Jesus Christ, we begin with the fact that he indeed lived and died when the Bible states that he lived and died. Then he performed marvelous deeds, and that he made a major impression on the civilization of his day. So let's now review the historical setting into which Jesus Christ was born. The Roman and the Parthian empires were both powerful, well-established superpower rivals at the time Jesus was born. Rome ruled the Mediterranean region, and Parthia ruled Asian lands from modern Syria to the Indus River. Palestine was located within the Roman sphere of influence, the Roman Empire, but was close to the Euphrates River, constituting the Parthian border with Rome. 5 decades before the birth of Jesus, Rome and Parthia fought several battles, with one being fought near Antioch of Syria, very close to Palestine. In about 40 BC, the Parthians launched a major assault which drove the Romans out of Asia entirely for 3 years, from 40 to 37 BC. Palestine was within the Parthian Empire and was ruled by a Jewish vassal king of the Parthians. His name was Antigonus. At that time, King Herod, the Roman king of Judea, fled from the Parthians in fear of his life. While the Parthian-sponsored rule of Antigonus was brief, it was apparently popular with the Jews. When the Parthians withdrew across the Euphrates River, Antigonus, with Jewish support, attempted to maintain himself as king of the Jews, but was defeated by Herod. Mark Antony, the Roman leader famous for his dalliance with Cleopatra, ordered Antigonus beheaded, and Josephus records that this was done to compel the Jews to accept the hated Herod as their king. Mark Antony afterward led a massive invasion of Parthia, about 37 BC, but his army was totally defeated by the Parthians. Now, to help modern readers gain a frame of reference for these ancient events, these Roman-Parthian wars were more recent events for the people at the time Jesus was born than World War II and the Korean War are to modern readers today. Parthian rule over Palestine was therefore vividly remembered by many in Jewish society as being preferable to Roman rule. Parthia's victory over Mark Antony led to a long period of peace between Rome and Parthia, with the Euphrates River serving as the border between their two vast empires. This prolonged period of peaceful relations lasted from about 36 BC until 58 AD, including not only all of Jesus Christ's life, but also the early period of the Apostolic Church as well. And Rawlinson records that it was an established Roman policy not to provoke a Parthian war during that period of time, so long as both empires agreed to coexist on separate banks of the Euphrates River. And Rawlinson comments on this peaceful interlude as follows. He said, quote, "It's a well-known fact that Augustus left as a principle of policy to his successors that the Roman Empire had reached its proper limits and could not with advantage be extended any further. This principle, followed with the utmost strictness of Tiberius, was accepted as a rule by all earlier Caesars." As long as the Caesars wanted peace with Parthia, Roman officials along Parthia's border, such as King Herod and Pontius Pilate, knew that they risked their positions and lives if they entangled Rome in an unwanted war with Parthia. Without this period of Parthian-Roman detente, it would have been impossible for some of the events of Jesus Christ's life to have occurred, as we'll see as we proceed. The first such event was the coming of the Magi, or the wise men, to pay homage to Jesus. Now, we read of this event in Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12, which becomes more important when it's considered in the overall context of Roman-Parthian relations. Now, Parthia's Magi, or Magi, however you want to pronounce it, first visit Jesus, and they frightened the entirety of the population of Jerusalem. As we discussed in the previous chapter, the Magi were powerful members of the Parthian bicameral body that elected Parthian monarchs, and they wielded great influence within the empire. I'm going to pause here and point out that here in the United States of America, all 43 or 4 of our presidents are descendants of King David, and they're related to Queen Elizabeth and to the royal families of Europe. This dynasty, even in the United States, Al Gore and George Bush running for president in the year 2000, didn't make any difference which one won. Both of them are descended from royalty. They're both descended from King David. Queen Elizabeth was descended from King David. So it's interesting to point out that here in America, we select our king every 4 years. This is a principle of law and Anglo-Saxon administration that goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. And while we said we want a king like all the nations around us in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the concepts of the jury system, and as we're seeing here, these magi, which today we call the judiciary, these people wear long flowing robes and they represent a vital function in our government, that is the function of the judges. Going on, one assembly was composed of members of the royal family of the Arsacids, and the other consisted of the priests, the Magi, and influential Parthians of non-royal blood, the wise men. The Magi and the wise men were jointly known as the Magistanes. In Matthew 2, verse 1, it states that wise men from the east came to worship Jesus. The term wise men, which appears in Matthew 2, verse 1, is not a generic description of these visitors, but was the proper title of the Parthian Magistanes. It's M-A-G-I-S-T-A-N-E-S, Magistanes. And the Greek word translated wise men is magician, or Magian, literally meaning Persian astronomer or priest, from which we derive the word Magi, M-A-G-I. Parthia governed Persia at the time of Christ, so the wise men cited in the Bible were Parthian nobles and or priests. And that's what we call a judge today, a priest. Or that's what we called our priests in the past, judges. And in fact, when you go before a court to this day, the courtroom is set out in the same way that the church is. You have an altar. In the courthouse, they call it a bench. In the church, they call it an altar. Where the choir sits, we call that the jury box, and both of them have a fence across the middle which represents the veil in the holy place of the temple, and you can't pass through the veil to approach the priest without an intercessor. So what you see in the courthouse, the temple, and what you see in the church, sometimes called temples, are these people that wear long flowing robes, priests and judges. Now, while traditional Christian accounts of this episode celebrate the coming of the three wise men, the Bible does not limit the number of the visiting Magi wise men to three men. Indeed, the biblical events and the realities of that time argue for a much larger contingent of Parthian magi than just three. Look at the account yourself. The Bible does not limit these magi, or wise men, to three. No number is given. Now, since we saw in previous chapters that the Parthians were descended from the 10 tribes of Israel and that their priests were likely descended from the tribe of Levi, it is likely that their delegation of Magi consisted of leading members of the 10 tribes of Israel. Because there are numerous Jews, or were numerous Jews, of the tribe of Judah in Parthia's empire, they may have been represented as well. Consequently, the delegation of Magi could easily have consisted of at least 10 or 12 men representing the various tribes of Israel. Also, the Bible confirms that the Magi did not visit the young Jesus in the manger in Bethlehem, as most nativity scenes depict at Christmas. But rather, they visited Jesus in a house sometime after his birth, as we read in the scripture. In Matthew 2, verse 11 states that this visit of the Magi took place in a house, not at the manger, when Jesus was old enough to be called a young child. He could have been a year old or more. Luke's version of Christ's birth in Luke 2, verses 8 through 40, mentions the shepherd's arrival at the manger, but makes no mention of any magi visiting Christ while he was in the manger. Matthew 2, verse 8 adds that Herod sent the magi to Bethlehem after conferring with the Jewish hierarchy about the prophesied location of the Messiah's birth. They cited Micah 5, verse 2, that the Messiah would originate in Bethlehem, and they were very likely familiar with Daniel 9, verses 25 and 26, which predicted that the arrival of the Messiah was due at that time. Herod privately met with the Parthian delegation and inquired when the star, which they followed, had first appeared. He apparently learned that this period of time was almost 2 years, because he killed all the male children in Bethlehem under 2 years of age in an attempt to kill the Messiah, whom he regarded as a competitor for his position as king of the Jews. Now, although the Bible tells us that the star appeared to the wise men almost 2 years prior to his birth, this offers inexact information in determining how old Jesus was when the wise men came to him. The wise men were prominent people in Parthia when the star appeared, and they had to make a very time-consuming journey to reach Judea. It took time to prepare the costly gifts to present to the Messiah, set their affairs in order for a long absence, organize and equip a caravan, obtain an armed escort for protection, and then to make the slow, lengthy journey to Judea in a caravan of pack animals, since the star's appearance was not necessarily timed to coincide exactly with the time of Jesus' birth, or when Jesus was born. He may have been a few months, or up to 2 years old at the time of the Magi's arrival. Now consider also that Matthew 2, verses 1 through 3 states, quote, "Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen a star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him." Now why was Jerusalem troubled? Well, the arrival of the Magi's caravan in Jerusalem was a very public affair, because all Jerusalem was troubled. All Jerusalem was troubled by their arrival. What was it about the Magi's caravan that scared the Roman leaders and the whole city of Jerusalem? Well, the Magi, a delegation of high Parthian officials, came to Jerusalem in a caravan loaded with costly treasures and escorted by a strong force of armed Parthian soldiers. And since the Magi were high officials of the Parthian government, they would routinely travel with a substantial escort of Parthian soldiers to guarantee their protection. Since they were traveling with many costly treasures to present to the newborn Messiah, their escort may have been unusually large. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 41% of what you create and produce. The government gets 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of special? Now, if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24% and the government will net 76. For working twice as hard, producing twice as much, you'll net $4,000 more, or about 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. So the first $50,000, you get to net 41%. The second $50,000, you get to net 8%. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little. To order your free general law CD package, just call me direct and order yours today. The number is 417-273-4967, or you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. And remember, My Tax and Status School is also available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. You got to call right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about a unique Bible passage here. Remember, in the early chapters of the book of Matthew, it talks about the birth of Jesus. We're all familiar with Christmas, aren't we? We heard about the three wise men, these magi. But when we look at it in the light of historical events going on at the time, taking a look at the two ancient superpowers of Parthia allied with Scythia, making a counterpoise, a counterbalance to Roman power or the Roman Empire, and that these two empires were in the Middle East, facing each other on the banks of the Euphrates River, and that they had fought several battles, and that the Parthians had always defeated their enemies, the Romans. Up to this point, they were undefeated. Now, the Parthians weren't trying to destroy the Roman Empire. The Romans had come on several incursions into Parthian territory and were severely and soundly trounced and thrown out. They had launched their own, as George Bush would call it, preemptive strike against the Romans in about 40 BC, and for 3 years threw the Romans out of Palestine and Syria, clear back out of Asia altogether, and then retreated back to their Euphrates River and then minded their own business. Now, when the Magi arrived in Jerusalem, the whole city was troubled. They arrived about 2 years after the birth of the Messiah. He was now a young child, close to 2 years old, because Herod had ordered the destruction of all of the male children from 2 years old and under to make sure that he got the right guy. We want to make sure that we kill the Messiah. Well, the Magi's caravan would have included large numbers of servants, animal handlers, cooks, for such a long journey, and these people alone could have constituted many hundreds of people. And given the fact that many high Parthian officials and very expensive treasures were in the caravan, there may have been many thousands of Parthian soldiers escorting the caravan. This is not an overstatement. Josephus records that treasure caravans bringing expensive offerings to Jerusalem from Jews living in Parthian territory did so with many 10,000 men as escorts. In ancient times, traveling with expensive items was dangerous, and there was danger not only from brigands, but also from local satraps who might use their armies to conquer a treasure train passing through their territory. If Jewish commoners from Parthia were allowed to travel to Jerusalem with the equivalent of several infantry divisions as escorts, would an important delegation of Parthia's ruling class and treasure train of gifts have been accompanied by any fewer armed escorts? And if the Parthian column had included many 10,000s of soldiers, it would have justified the widespread fear in Jerusalem caused by their arrival. In the previous chapter, we learned that ancient Chinese historical accounts recorded that the Parthians sent 20,000 cavalry just to escort a Chinese ambassador into Parthian territory. Plutarch records that Serenus, a Parthian military commander, and no doubt a member of the Magistanes, traveled on routine business in a caravan of cavalry servants and attendants the size of a baggage train of 1,000 camels, at least 10,000 men. If one Parthian leader traveled with so large a caravan en route on a business trip within Parthia, then how large do you think this caravan of the Magi, a whole delegation of Parthian nobles carrying great treasures to worship a newborn king? It was large enough to frighten the whole city of Jerusalem. And the wise men coming to Jesus were not bringing just a few samples of gold and other precious things that they carried in their personal saddlebags. They were coming to worship a royal-born child. So they likely had a whole pack train of animals loaded with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The Messiah, when he went out to teach, wasn't just some poor, lowly fellow that we're being told of. He was trained as a carpenter. His father, Joseph, was called a carpenter. And they said, "Isn't this the carpenter's son?" Hey, wait a minute, if this guy hung on to what was just brought to him from the 10 tribes of Israel to the east, he was a pretty wealthy man. In fact, as this chapter goes on to show, we won't have time here on the air, but you can get a copy of this book, and I highly recommend it. And you can read about the travels of this fellow, the Messiah. And for you Mormon people out there, you have a belief in your church that the Messiah traveled to the New World. Collins can prove that. Collins can prove it. I haven't seen the proof from the Mormon church, but I do see it here in these books written by Stephen Collins, and you can get a copy of it, by the way, from BibleBlessings.com. No, excuse me, it isn't BibleBlessings.com. It's BibleBlessings.net, BibleBlessings.net, or just write the Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Like if you put a $20 money order, then they'd send you a book. I think that's about what I paid here was $20. So these wise men then coming to Jesus were not bringing just a few samples of gold, boys and girls. They were bringing a whole pack train. This would be the equivalent of a summit conference. You know, this is the kind of thing that you see when Ronald Reagan goes to meet Gorbachev or something. You know, they have this big meeting over here, and it stirs up a lot of hate and discontent, like George Bush's recent summit meeting with the G7 down in Georgia stirred up a lot of hate and discontent and a lot of consternation among the locals when they pulled into town. Their caravan was so huge that it was a cause celebre in Jerusalem. The whole city was in an uproar over their arrival. And that argues for a very visible, very impressive Parthian caravan arriving in Jerusalem. The sheer size of the caravan, its treasures, and its escorts awed King Herod and the whole city to the point that they were all troubled. Now, this indicates that the Parthian caravan had so many armed escorts that many feared that it was an invasion force coming to besiege Jerusalem and start a new Roman-Parthian war. However, their announced reason coming to visit a royal-born Messiah could have electrified a city of Jews who intensely wanted the Messiah to come and free them from Roman rule. The Jewish hierarchy understood the Parthians were looking for the Messiah, as they quickly looked for messianic prophecies to locate the city of his birth. After their consultations with Herod, the high Jewish officials, the Parthian delegation traveled to Bethlehem to worship Jesus and to present their gifts to him. By this time, Matthew 2:11 states that Jesus and Mary were living in a house. They weren't in the manger. They weren't there at the stable, so they were no longer staying at the manger. The Magi's journey to Bethlehem would have been closely followed by Herod's spies. Joseph was then warned by an angel to flee quickly into Egypt, in Matthew 2, verse 13, to avoid Herod's impending slaughter of Bethlehem's young male children. Since Herod's edict applied only to Bethlehem, there would have been no need for Joseph, Mary, and Jesus to flee unless they were still in Bethlehem. Since Joseph and Mary actually lived in Galilee, as we see in Luke 2, verse 4, the fact that they were in a house in Bethlehem indicates that this must have been weeks after Jesus' birth, while Mary was regaining the strength to make an overland trip back to Nazareth. Their flight to Egypt took them completely out of Herod's area of jurisdiction. Now, Herod made the mistake of assuming that the Messiah would be born to a family native to the Bethlehem area, since Luke 2, verse 39 states that Joseph, Mary, and Jesus returned to Galilee not long after Jesus was born. It seems apparent that the stay of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus in Egypt was very brief. Historical sources disagree on the year of King Herod's death, but there is persuasive evidence that Herod died soon after giving his cruel order to murder the boy babies of Bethlehem. Matthew 2, verses 14 through 19 states that Jesus and his parents returned from Egypt as soon as Herod was dead. And the account applies that their stay in Egypt was brief. Now, this author acknowledges that there are differing scholarly and historical viewpoints concerning the year of Jesus' birth. And while many people assume that Christ was born in a theoretical year zero, scholarly opinions for the year of Jesus' birth focus on the time frame of 5 BC to 2 BC. And it is significant that Jesus' parents were faithful to God's law requiring circumcision on the eighth day, as we see in Leviticus 12, verses 2 and 3, and to Jewish custom by making an offering to God at the temple in Jerusalem to consecrate their firstborn male child, as we read in Luke 2, 21 through 24. Now, this is an important observation, as it shows Jesus was raised by a Jewish family that devoutly obeyed God's laws, and that Jesus was circumcised on the eighth day, as was Jewish custom, and indeed was Israelite custom. And it should be worthy of note here that we Israelites still, to this day, practice circumcision. Everybody else in the world looks at us like we're nuts. Chinese, Japanese, Russians, and other people, you know, they look around and they say, well, what's this crazy custom? Hey, we've been doing this, boys and girls, for 3,100 years. Now, it's a tribute to the power of Caesar's policy that the Roman-Parthian peace be maintained, that war did not result from this statement, for Herod could easily have taken it as an insult. He could have flown into a rage and yelled, how dare you ask to see another king of the Jews beside me? I am the king of the Jews. That Herod swallowed his gargantuan pride and meekly answered the Parthians is quite noteworthy. And this is a tribute not only to Caesar's policy to maintain the peace, but also to recognition that a sizable Parthian army had come to Jerusalem to escort the Magi. Herod's meek response to the highly provocative question of the Parthian officials does imply that he was intimidated by the many Parthian soldiers who accompanied the Magi, because the whole city was troubled by the Parthians and their arrival. The presence of so many Parthian soldiers surely sparked rumors in Jerusalem that a new Parthian-Roman war was imminent. Herod may even have suspected that the Parthians' question was designed to provoke an incident which would lead to an outbreak of hostilities and his removal from the throne. So Herod and all of Jerusalem was surprised but relieved to learn that the Parthian Magi and soldiers had arrived with peaceful intent. Herod may have been expecting to hear an ultimatum for the surrender of Jerusalem to Parthia when the Magi were ushered into his presence. Some observations must be made about the star which led the Magi to Jesus. Some have proposed that the star was a comet or a celestial phenomenon, although the biblical accounts indicate that this was not the case. The biblically described star moved, leading the Magi over a long east-west route from Parthia to Judea. And Matthew 2, verse 9 states that it finally stood over where the young child was. Well, simple logic confirms that no comet or celestial phenomenon in the sky could possibly pinpoint a single city, much less stand over an individual child on the earth's surface. Nevertheless, that is what the biblical star did. So the Bible periodically uses the word star to represent angels. You'll see that in Job 38, verse 7, and Revelation 1:20. And there's good reason to believe that the star which led the Parthian nobles to a specific child in a specific house in a specific city in Judea was an angel of God. Nothing else makes sense. Only an angel, a spirit being, could literally stand over the baby Jesus to designate one specific child to the Parthian nobles. And also nothing in the Bible account indicates that this star was visible to anyone other than the Magi, the wise men. And in Matthew 2:2, it states that the Magi saw the star, but the context argues that no one else ever saw it. Verse 7 relates that Herod asked the Magi when the star appeared to them, indicating that no one in Judea was aware of any such star. So if a striking celestial object had appeared in the sky, Herod and his astrologers would already have known the exact date and hour on which it had occurred, which argues for this is probably an angel, not a celestial body. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. And the income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And this income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. Social Security also violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed, and then we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft, in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention followed that better way. And that's why I contend that you and I should learn and to practice that better way of life. Now, for more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can order yours either by going to the website, georgegordon.org, then click onto the email and send me an email request, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Jesus Christ and the connection between the Messiah's birth in Jerusalem, the arrival of the Magi, the Parthian, and the Roman empires, and the political implications of this event in the biblical description. So after leading the Parthians to Judea, the star disappeared, forcing the Parthians to ask Herod for directions. So after the Magi left Herod, the star again reappeared to them and led them directly to Bethlehem, as we see in Luke 2, verse 9, and finally stood over one specific child, Jesus, in verse 10. And it states that the Magi rejoiced that the star had again appeared to show them where to go. Obviously, the star which appeared disappeared and reappeared for the Magi, but which was apparently not seen by any other humans. And it had to be an angel. Supporting this fact is that Luke 2, verses 8 through 15 records that the birth of Jesus was announced to shepherds by angels, speaking to them out of a heavenly light, which accompanied their appearance. Well, God also used an angel to warn Joseph to flee to Egypt. Since God used angels to direct the movements of persons in the event surrounding Christ's birth, it would have been completely inconsistent for God to also send an angel to guide the Magi's movements. Having found Jesus, the Magi worshipped him, offering costly gifts of gold, myrrh, and frankincense. They were then warned by God, in a dream, in Matthew 2, verse 12, not to return to Herod, resulting in the prompt exit of the Magi and their many escorts from Judea. When Herod realized that he had been fooled, he wrathfully killed all of the young male children of Bethlehem in a vain effort to kill the Messiah. However, there is no indication that Herod made any attempt to overtake or to punish the Magi. As high Parthian nobles, they had diplomatic immunity, and Herod dared not anger Caesar by provoking the Parthians. Also, Herod's garrison troops could have been vastly outnumbered by the size of the Magi's military escorts. And there's another important aspect of this remarkable episode. While it is not surprising that Jewish leaders during Herod's reign were sufficiently familiar with the prophetic writings to pinpoint for Herod exactly where the Messiah would be born, it is nevertheless surprising that God was working so closely with members of the Parthian ruling class. Now, this makes no biblical sense unless, A, the Parthians were descended from the 10 tribes of Israel, or B, the Magi, the Parthian priests, included some Levites. Now, during his ministry, Jesus Christ asserted that he had not been sent to the Gentiles, but only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Matthew 15, verses 24 through 28 shows the reluctance of Jesus to assist a Gentile. Now, that's pretty significant. Remember that Jesus didn't come to teach Gentiles. He didn't come here, you know, to send missionaries off to Africa or Asia or someplace, you know, to teach the Africans to sing, "Yes, Jesus loves me." Jesus Christ was a geopolitical person. He was a king. He did not come to set up his kingdom at that time. He came to establish himself as the qualified ruler, the qualified new king, to displace Satan at some given time in the future. We haven't arrived there yet. He's qualified to become the king, and when he comes back, he's coming back to set up a world-ruling empire. We see that in numerous prophecies in the Scripture. This is why we're waiting for this event called the second coming of Christ. Sometimes it's referred to in the Bible as I think it was Peter that made this observation, you know, that the skeptics would be saying, you know, where's the promise of his coming, and that, you know, this or that is slower than the second coming of Christ. Geopolitical events occur over thousands of years in Bible prophecy, but you and I only live for 70. 70 years is not a very long period of time when we're talking about a 6,000-year program that is still to run 1,100 more years. We're still talking about a 1,000-year millennial reign and then a 100-year great white throne judgment after that. We're talking about three resurrections in Revelation verse chapter 20. While most Christians are talking about going to heaven and Christmas, Easter, and New Year's, the Bible is a book on geopolitics, and it deals with world-ruling empires and a coming world-ruling empire to be headed by God himself in that seventh millennial day called the millennium, pictured as the Sabbath. Now, we're talking about geopolitics here. We're not talking about religion. This doesn't have anything to do with, "Yes, Jesus loves me," and sending missionaries over to Africa. The Bible is a book on politics, geopolitics, world politics. Deals with world-ruling empires. It has from the Garden of Eden forward. It deals with humankind, and it deals with a plan, a purpose, an intelligent, directed plan revealed to a small number of people who are going to participate in that governmental process. That is, he's calling kings and priests today for the express purpose of heading that government. It's called the Better Resurrection. Well, after leading the Parthians to Judea, the star disappeared, forcing the Parthians to ask Herod for directions. Now, here's this big delegation. We don't know how big it was, but it was big enough to disturb Herod and everybody around him. It was big enough that the Roman garrisons in Jerusalem didn't challenge him militarily. You know, it would be kind of like, you know, just picture this, you know, an American army going into Mexico looking for Pancho Villa, remember that? Blackjack Pershing did that in 1916. They just drove across the Rio Grande River looking for this guy. You didn't see the Mexican army, you know, attacking the United States. I'm sure that the Mexicans were somewhat distraught that this military incursion occurred, but it didn't upset American-Mexican relations. The Mexicans weren't in any mood for or any in any way trying to provoke the Colossus of the North into some kind of a war. Now, having found Jesus, the Magi worshipped him. They offered him costly gifts. And remember, there's another important aspect of this remarkable episode, that while it's not surprising that Jewish leaders during Herod's reign were sufficiently familiar with the prophetic writings to pinpoint for Herod exactly where the Messiah would be born, it is surprising that God was working so closely with members of the Parthian ruling class. And throughout the Old Testament, God worked almost exclusively with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You don't see God going over here to the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks and Romans or anybody else talking to them, you know, with all of their gods. It wasn't until after the death of Christ that Gentiles were even given equal access to the God of Israel. The fact that God was working intimately with the Parthian nobility, sending them angelic messengers, giving them divine messages in dreams, confirms that the Parthians had to be descended from the 10 tribes of Israel, which had migrated into Asia. And the fact that some of the Parthian ruling classes were apparently worshippers of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is most revealing. God obviously considered these Parthians to be righteous men under the terms of his laws, or he would not have been dealing with them so personally. That educated Parthians were ready to visit and worship the Messiah at the time of Christ's birth indicates that they were also familiar with the prophecies of the Old Testament. Who but transplanted Israelites would have been looking for the Messiah at that time? Now, although we're jumping ahead in the narrative, consider the events of Acts 2, verse 9, which states that the Parthians were among those who made pilgrimages to Jerusalem for the Feast of Weeks, known to Christians today as Pentecost. And verse 9 also mentions Medes, Elamites, and dwellers in Mesopotamia as being present at the feast, and all of those regions were provinces of the Parthian Empire. We know that portions of the 10 tribes had been relocated to the cities of the Medes, so the presence of devout visitors from Media and Persia were likely designates, or most likely designates, people from the 10 tribes of Israel who still lived in Media and Persia. And interestingly, verse 9 also mentions dwellers in Asia were present. Dwellers in Asia. The word Asia has clouded origins, but the Encyclopedia Britannica tells us that it's probably Asia, as an Assyrian or Hebrew word, and was first used with a specific or restricted local application, a more extended signification having eventually been given to it. Well, that's the story on Parthia. That's not the whole story. I've just given you the brief overview here in a few programs here to introduce you to this concept. Bible Blessings, remember, is the name of the publisher, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. You can get to them on BibleBlessings.net. Again, that's BibleBlessings.net. Or go to Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. All right, we're about out of time. We're going to have to close it off right here. We'll be back again tomorrow with a new topic, and we'll figure out what we want to talk about. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. And the Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports about law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Well, there's a signal that says my time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.